Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pixels and Profits episode number 2. So we're going to keep rolling here. Thanks for all the folks that send really great feedback about our first episode. Really happy how that turned out and how much people seem to enjoy it. But today we're going to be shifting focus to console wars. So meaning the big three, Sony, Nintendo, and Microsoft. And again, if you don't know who we are, with us today, you have myself, Joseph Kim, content contributor for Game Makers and CEO of Lila Games, Matthew Contraman, director of research from Roundhill Investments, and Brian Peganoff from Timber Advisors. So just to set the stage for the discussion today, we're going to start kind of like the first half with a focus on profits, meaning a characterization of the console market today and specific market dynamics. And the second half of our discussion will shift to more of a pixels-based discussion, meaning high-level strategy, themes, and trends. But let's go ahead and dive right in. Brian, can you tee us up on the high-level market dynamics?
Yeah, so we figured it would make sense to kind of set the table here with an overview of the three main companies that we're going to be discussing today, namely Sony, Nintendo, and Microsoft. We'll get a few bits and pieces of some other players in there too. A key thing many investors look for in public equities is how exposed a company is to a certain theme or trend. And since we're talking about consoles and specifically the modern day console war, it's a good place to start. So let's kick things off with Sony and its PlayStation business. So Sony is a publicly traded company with a market capitalization of about $120 billion. So it's a fairly massive company. They did about $83 billion of revenue in fiscal 22, and they're projecting about 82.8 in fiscal 23, so roughly flattish year on year. They also do a bunch of other things ranging from music to movies to financial services. The PlayStation gaming business is called Game and Network Services, and that business did about $26 billion of revenue in fiscal 22, and they're projecting about 28% in fiscal 20 or $28 billion in fiscal 23. That's about 7 to 8% year-on-year growth. They also report adjusted OI by segment, which is a loose proxy for EBITDA, and they did $2.4 billion in fiscal 22, which is about 9.2% margin, and they're looking for $2.6 billion in fiscal 23, which is, again, roughly flat. So gaming is about 31 to 34% of Sony's total business and about 20 to 21% of OI or IO. So I classify that as pretty damn important, but it's not necessarily mission critical. So Matt, what else do you have to add there?
Yeah, I don't think that people realize that Sony's a bank. They, you know, Sony Financial used to be a loosely affiliated company. And a few years ago, they bought it out and consolidated it. They're actually in talks to spin it out again. So, you know, fun financial engineering, but people don't realize that Sony's a bank. They're also like the leader in smartphone camera chips. So like they are a big supplier for Apple and a lot of other smartphone vendors. So like when you look at the overall revenue piece, the smartphone market's been weak. That's a lot of that is driven by their lens, their image sensor business being weak. You know, there's lots of other things going on. They still make computers. They still make TVs, right? So there's a lot of moving pieces in Sony's business. I mean, Brian, you're probably going to dive into Microsoft next or third, right? But it's a similar story where Sony is really important to the games industry, particularly the console games industry. But as a percentage of the whole business, it's only 30% of revenue, 20-something percent of operating income. So it's just important to keep in mind, like, you know, how this flows through the P&L of Sony as a consolidated entity.
And we're going to go into Nintendo next. We're going to dive Sega, Sony, Nintendo, Microsoft for each of these. So Nintendo is a publicly traded company with a market cap of about 56 billion USD. They did about 12.2 billion in fiscal 22 and guided to 11.5 billion in fiscal 23. So that's down about 5.5% year over year. They also did about 4.25 billion OI in fiscal 22 and guided to 3.6 in fiscal 23. And that represents 35% and 31.5% OI margins, respectively. So significantly more profitable than Sony's games business. And at a high level, you can attribute this to a higher tie ratio of software, tie ratio, and an extraordinarily high mix of first-party content. So the Switch hardware guided to 15 million units, which is down 17% year-over-year from 18 million. And again, this is kind of like end of a cycle. And then the software, the most profitable part of the business, to 180 million units versus 214 million last year. So that's down 16%. The important part here to note is like almost 97% of their business comes from gaming hardware and software. So this is the very definition of mission critical. This is a gaming pure play, very, very rare. So this mix will go down a good amount next quarter with the inclusion of IP related income from their Mario movie.
Brian, maybe I could just stop you real quick, just because one feedback I did get from some of the listeners is that they had some trouble understanding some of the terms, but just for a couple of the things that you mentioned, OI meaning operating income, and then tie ratio is the, if I remember correctly, it's the total amount of software divided by the total number of console units. So basically, Okay, so maybe I'll like, as we go through, if other terms pop up, I'll just kind of jump in and kind of explain a little bit for a more general audience.
Yeah, definitely helpful to define some of those terms. And, you know, it's also important to compare when we're comparing Sony and Nintendo, where they are in the cycle. And we'll talk about the console cycles in a bit, but Nintendo's at the later stages of the Switch cycle. And So that's when you start to see hardware sales decline, software sales go up. That's when you make more of your profit dollars, because hardware is a lower margin business than software. So, you know, it is important to make that consideration when thinking about the numbers. The other thing I'll just mention with Nintendo, corporate management teams, they all have different strategies with how they give guidance. A lot of them tend to sandbag and kind of, you know, guide very conservatively so they can beat it. If you actually go through, like, you know, CEO and exec compensation, you can pretty much figure out why they do that, because a lot of them are incentivized to beat their initial guidance. So they sandbag it so they can beat it. But Nintendo, I think the last couple of years has beaten their software unit sales by like 40% versus their initial guidance. So like, it's not even like 10%, like it's a massive beat the last few years. So we got to take their guidance with a grain of salt. Now, as we look ahead to the next year, the release slate's a lot lighter. Like, yes, they have Zelda, but once Zelda's out, like there's pretty much nothing else on the first party side. So versus prior years where they had games that were coming that they were just being conservative about, like even like Mario Tennis ended up being a massive seller, which probably had to do with COVID to a degree, but it's still just important to keep in mind that this is a company that historically has guided very conservatively as well.
And so let's move to Microsoft. And for this one, it's a completely different ballgame. Publicly traded company, obviously, with a market cap of just under 2.5 trillion with a T. So this is the second most valuable company on the planet. It's about $300 to $400 billion less than Apple in a given day. So in gaming, they do about $11 to $12 billion of revenue against $200 billion plus for the full company. So it's about 5 to 6% of the mix and maybe 75-25 software to hardware. If we add Activision to the mix, which is a big if, we're looking to be about a $20 billion run rate, and this will approach high single digits. So in no realm of possibility is this a gaming pure play. It is a rounding error. What I would mention is that Microsoft became incrementally more positive and vocal about the gaming business whenever Fortnite came out in 2017, because they saw a big flood of business coming in from people buying stuff in Fortnite and having 30-ish percent of the console market. Since that time period, they've made some acquisitions that have boosted their revenue number and overall mix. But at a high level, it's kind of been pushed to the sidelines. And their most recent quarter, hardly mentioned, brought up at the end. And they're just giving indicative guidance based upon rate of change.
Yeah, I mean, just from, well, let's quote our good friend Eric Kress, right? For Microsoft, gaming is mice nuts. It's... Xbox is very similar to Sony. Xbox is really important to the gaming industry, particularly the console industry again, right? But for Microsoft on a consolidated basis, they're the second largest cloud vendor. They're the largest SaaS vendor in the world. They are a leader in generative AI, and that's going to be a huge business for them. Dan Ives at Wedbush saying it's going to add $300 billion to their market cap because of the revenue potential, right? So, you know, when you think about gaming relevant to Microsoft, it's, Activision's going to cost $69 billion. That was the deal price. That's less than 1 year of free cash flow for Microsoft. They will make that money back from everything else they do in less than a year, whether or not they buy Microsoft. So we're just talking about orders of magnitudes of money that just doesn't exist in most other companies.
And, you know, I don't have much else to add on the Microsoft side, but I do think whether we talk about it now or later, I think the other thing that might be interesting to discuss is just the difference in terms of strategic approach. But, you know, whether we talk about that now or later, up to you guys.
I think what we're planning on doing is taking a quick dive into, maybe not quick, but the last few generations of hardware.
Yeah, let's do that.
And then it's been funny. I played a little catch up over the past week since we've been planning to do this for a while. And I wanted to draw some conclusions around what drove successful outcomes for hardware console units in the past. And I think what I came up with was three things, and I'd love to hear your views on it. The first one is speed to market. in the specific generation. The second one is differentiated features and innovations specific to that console. And then the third one is software lineup. And this is in no specific order, but love to hear if you guys have any different views.
Yeah, I think in particular, you know, the importance of exclusive content, I think, at least for me, kind of defined the initial success of those platforms. It might be interesting to think about how much of an impact you guys think that has today. But at least for me, that's how I made my early console decisions is, you know, where am I going to be able to play a specific game?
I definitely think that first party content is the only, it's the only factor that has spanned all of the most recent generations. Like if we look at technology and differentiated factors, like that was huge for Xbox in the beginning. And Brian, you've laid out some of the numbers we're going to get into, but they were the first one to have online multiplayer and a console, right? That was huge. Halo 2 was the first ever online multiplayer game. Like that was a huge selling point for Xbox at the time. You know, then they tried the Kinect and that was just a huge flop. So, you know, it's, that's been hit or miss. Nintendo hit or miss, right? They seem to, you know, TikTok between generations. The Wii was a massive success with how they structured the controller with the motion sensors, but the Wii U was a massive flop with that weird tablet thing. But then the Switch was amazingly successful. So, you know, they do seem to kind of, that seems to be hit and miss depending on the time, but I think it also ties back to the software. What software takes advantage of those technologies? And I think that's why I think the first party content or even second party content, when you look at Sony more recently, is more of the thing that has the most staying power across generations. I've also heard people talk about distribution. Like someone was making the point that Sony has better distribution into Africa and other parts of Asia. It's like, yes, that's true. But how many PS5s are being sold in sub-Saharan Africa? Like consoles are mostly a Japan, Western Europe and North American market, maybe a little bit of South America, maybe a little bit of Northern Africa, but like majority of the market is Japan, Western Europe, North America. So like, let's just, you know, Microsoft has distribution in two of those three very well. They've always been outsold by Sony in Japan just because Sony has that local market. But, you know, so I think distribution also is one that on the margin, it makes a difference, but it's not the key driver.
Yeah, there's a famous quote from, well, not a famous quote, there's kind of a niche quote from this guy, Roger McNamee, who's a famous investor, but, you know, he once said that between the content and the audience, everything in between is a choice. And so from that perspective, you know, like, why did I buy an Xbox? I want to play Halo. Why, you know, why did I get Nintendo? Because of Pokemon. Why did I get PlayStation? Because of Final Fantasy. So yeah, definitely probably still relevant today.
So let's we'll hit the time machine and we're going to start at the sixth generation, which is the start of the modern console war. And this is a period defined from 1998 to 2013. So this is starting with the PlayStation 2, which was launched in March of 2000. It did about 157.8 million units over the course of its lifetime. And some of the best exclusive games on that platform were Final Fantasy X, Shadow of Colossus, Devil May Cry, God of War, Metal Gear Solid, Kingdom Hearts. There was a ton. Like, this was just a total assault on gaming. Everything was just landing. Success drivers for the actual hardware. So first to market, and we'll talk about when the Xbox came out in a second, really beefy specs. The launch content was here or there, but exploited the great games that we just kind of listed out. And in terms of innovation, it was the first to DVD. It was backward compatible. It had the DualShock 2 with rumble and pressure sensitivity, and an optional network adapter, which came out later. And then like peripherals were starting to be a thing. And that was really important for Activision and Rock Band back in the day. Shifting over to the GameCube, that came out in September of 2001, did about 21.7 million units. So that was deemed to be somewhat of a failure. Some of the highlights in terms of software was Metroid Prime, EA Sports titles, which weren't exclusive, Zelda titles, and Super Smash Brothers. So in terms of success drivers, there really wasn't one. It was mostly thought of as a flop. It wasn't super differentiated, no online gaming or third-party support, but it was very family-focused. with four controllers, and it introduced the C-Stick for camera rotation. So I think the one thing to point out about Nintendo, and if you ever want to learn more about the gaming industry, I would suggest reading about the early days of Nintendo. They've always learned a little bit about stuff they messed up on, and they've turned that into major successes down the line. So it's a very durable, enduring company, and its innovation is really at its core. It reminds me a little bit of Apple. Anyway, shifting over to Xbox, this was launched in November of 2001. And remember, March 2000 was PS2. So we had a lot of lead time there. This did 24.7 million units. The major games were Halo and Halo and Halo. It had a built-in hard drive, an Ethernet port, which Matt already alluded to, and a media center. And I would say the main challenges here were the price point. It was a bit more expensive than the Sony offering. It was late. It lacked really intense backward compatibility, although it did support it. And there were some struggles with branding. So I don't know how that resonates with you guys. What were you doing in 1998?
I was playing a lot of those PS2 games in particular, right? Like, so Final Fantasy X is one of my all-time favorites. So I was playing the hell out of that, and as well as a bunch of other titles like Armored Core, Bushido Blade. So yeah, that was like a magical gaming time for me in one of the consoles I played the most of.
I was hard into Halo. I was a big Xbox gamer. Halo 2, under the radar, I think one of my favorite games of all time is SSX Tricky, though. Kind of like a cartoon arcadey snowboarding game. I just like, you had the cheat codes. You could turn on the, unlimited ult, and you could just kind of like do the crazy tricks. That was a lot of fun. We also skipped over Gen 5, which is N64. And I think to the point of Nintendo kind of being this TikTok success, not success, N64 was one of the most successful consoles ever, still is. GameCube, not so much. Then they did really well again. So I mean, with the Wii after that. So, I mean, I know we're going to go to the next one right away, but I sometimes it's hard to just figure out what Nintendo did wrong. I think with the Wii U, you can look at it and say this made no sense. But when you look like the GameCube, like made sense. It just, whatever reason, didn't hit.
Nintendo was always super solid on those handhelds, as you guys alluded to, with just the Pokemon and things like that. But console was a hard shift for them, and they didn't figure out till quite a bit later. For me, I've been a Sony fanboy my entire life, unabashed. At this time, though, I was mainly playing PC games like Warcraft and Starcraft and things like that, so I hadn't really made the full transition yet. I did mess around with things like EA Sports titles and things. I would be buying those things the year after they came out for $7 at GameStop, and that's how I live my life. So let's fast forward to the seventh generation. So that's 2005 to 2017. The PlayStation 3 launched in November of 2006. We can also take a quick step forward to Xbox 360, which launched in November 2005. So we're going to look at the impacts there of speed to market. For PS3, some of the leading titles were Uncharted, Last of Us, God of War 3, Infamous, and Killzone 2. In terms of innovation, it was the first to Blu-ray. It had full suite of online connectivity, not just an adapter. PlayStation Move, which is kind of like the Kinect. No one cared after a while. Multimedia support. The one thing that I think was actually kind of cool that this generation came out with was achievements. And I think that was a really important way for console companies to lock in their customers over a long period of time, alongside just like gaming chat or gaming social, right? Like this is where you started to meet your friends that you never actually meet. So that's kind of a cool innovation for the era. This is also the era of the Wii, which came out in November of 2006, so lockstep with PS3. And that did 101.6 million units. It was a major success. This was the era of Wii Sports and Mario Kart and Wii Fit, Super Smash Brawl, and Wii Play. And the biggest innovation they made, obviously, was the Wii motion controls. It was super casual focused. It was a virtual console as well, so had old games to download. It had online connectivity, a first for the Nintendo ecosystem. It had the Mii avatars, which is kind of the first step to personalizing yourself inside of your games, and some backward compatibility. Xbox 360, again, that was November of 2005, and that did 85.7 million units. So this was a banner era for consoles in general. Like everyone succeeded in some way. Microsoft came to market with games like Halo 3 and Gears of War, Forza, Mass Effect, the first one, and Crackdown. They also had achievements, PC cross-platform compatibility, the Kinect sensor, which Matt can reminisce about a little bit, Xbox Live Arcade, Blu-ray enhanced multimedia. And the biggest notable challenge for Microsoft that became a bit of a nagging, well, actually kind of more like a heroic thing looking back over the years, was the Red Ring of Death. And we also had a really good cycle for proliferation of handhelds. So the DS came out in November of 2004, and that did about 154 million units over the lifetime. PSP in March of 2005, 81 million units. And this is also the era of like Mario and Pokemon Black and White, Zelda, Mario Kart, Animal Crossing on Nintendo handhelds. And for PlayStation, GTA Liberty City Stories, God of War, Monster Hunter, Final Fantasy VIII, and Metal Gear Solid. So this was a really interesting generation. So what were you guys doing in 2005?
Yeah, so of those platforms, interestingly, I was probably on handheld most. So playing like Pokemon, Advance Wars, Disgaea, just a bunch of games on the DS in particular. But I think one thing people forget is that during that period when the Wii came out, it was like a little bit of a cultural phenomenon with like so many people playing Wii Sports. And the word on the street at that time is based upon the success of Wii Sports that Nintendo was then really trying to think about adapting a different kind of strategy in terms of the console platform itself as not being a gaming platform, but being more of a platform for a bunch of other stuff outside of gaming. So education, sports, and fitness. And they had all of these, word on the street was they were investing pretty significantly into trying to make it more of a general purpose, more family oriented platform. I don't think that ever, I mean, yeah, it never took off, but it was pretty interesting to remember just how big Wii Sports was and the kind of potential that potentially could have taken off if that platform actually was able to be more generalized outside of games.
I remember Madden on the Wii was really fun because you actually had to like throw and stuff like that. that was fun. That was different. I mean, it wasn't like I wasn't playing that online competitively. That was just fun to do with your friends, like in the basement, right? You know. But I also had an Xbox. I was playing Halo. Also had a DS, so I was playing Pokemon and everything. I mean, that was a great era for games. Mm-hmm. I do think, if I'm recalling correctly, a lot of those like non-gaming ambitions were killed by the financial crisis because, you know, this generation did occur, started in 05. This carried through the GFC in 07, 08. And I think a lot of companies cut a lot of non-core things at that point. I think a lot of those education, fitness type things got canned at that period. It's interesting. Well, you know, then as we get to the Switch, right, you know, definitely fitness has been something they've done a lot with. They have a lot of sports games, but Ring Fit, Mario Tennis, things like that are all more active. So, you know, it is interesting how that kind of came full circle.
Yeah, this was a pretty heavy era for me too. I definitely was part of the Wii revolution and things like that. I was still a Sony fanboy again. I played a lot of these single player games you already mentioned, Uncharted, God of War, whatever. But for me, the lasting impact from this generation was the tail end in 2014 when Bungie released Destiny 1. It was like the first time I've really seen a shooter game where you meet people and team up, and it's like a really cross intersection with PvP and PvE. And, that game transitioned to PS4 and eventually PC and got me back into that ecosystem. So that was certainly one that I look back on with a lot of fondness. Let's skip to the eighth generation. So this is 2012 to 2020. And this is the PlayStation 4, which was launched in November of 2013. That's at 117 million units. Let's do a quick flash down to Xbox so we can compare again. Xbox came out in November 2013 as well. So this was lockstep again. 51.26 million units. So just quick step back from the seventh generation to the eighth generation. Seventh generation, Sony's nervous because Microsoft is equal in share. And then they got their butt kicked in the eighth generation. So why? The games that PlayStation had, Spider-Man, God of War, Horizon Zero Dawn, Uncharted 4, The Last of Us Remastered, Ghost of Tsushima, Ratchet and Clank, Infamous Second Son. So it was just like just a barrage of amazing content that people still play today and like that they still iterate off of in current generation games. So the innovations, it was a powerhouse. It was a very strong system. It doubled down on gaming versus owning a living room. And that's kind of where Microsoft went, right? They wanted to be the multimedia center of your living room. Exclusives were epic, like we just said. The PSN evolution and then the DualShock 4, which with a touchpad and motion sensing. Remote play with the Vita, social sharing, and gameplay capture. The Wii U, which was another Nintendo flop, November of 2012, that did 13.6 million units. So it's like 10% of what they did in the last generation. They had some Mario Kart games, Super Mario 3D World, Splatoon, whatever. The gamepad had a controller, like a built-in touchscreen. And so why did it fail? The marketing was off. So it wasn't a material improvement over Wii, and it was kind of deemed as an accessory. There was a performance gap between the other two powerhouses, Microsoft and Sony. The software lineup was lacking a bit. The rise of mobile gaming is also attributed here because this was their first attempt at kind of like bridging that console to mobile form factor. And a lot of the innovations were happening on mobile where the distribution was way better and the monetization was way better, frankly. So I think the silver lining here, though, is that it prepared them for the Switch. So touching on Xbox One, this did, again, 51.26 million units lifetime. Halo 5, Forza, Gears of War 4, Sunset Overdrive, Sea of Thieves. So, like, you know, decent games. Some of them are still around today, but nothing that really shocked the world. And then this is also a decent hardware handheld cycle as well. So the 3DS was relevant. And this is also the era of Fortnite, which I'll touch on after the other guys go and tell us what they were doing in 2012.
Yeah, for me during this period, I think this was obviously, like, you know, Sony really took it away. For me, like, the previous reason for owning an Xbox was always Halo, and the Halo just wasn't the same at that point. And then to your point on content and the other titles available on Xbox, it just wasn't that powerful. Whereas, you know, on the PlayStation side, I mean, God of War by itself is worth buying, you know, a PlayStation 4. But I would say for me, I was mainly playing PS4, or at this point in my career, just buying a bunch of games and watching my kids play.
I was an Xbox One user. Less good content. It was a lot of sports at that time. I was big into just EA sports games in general, a lot of FIFA in that generation. I, you know, they got a lot of money from me. That was when Ultimate Team started to really blow up, and I got into that ecosystem, and that's a drain on your wallet over time.
I think for me, the most important title of this generation, and maybe the generations before, was Fortnite coming out in 2017. I had a really early look at that game when it was just kind of first being conceived. There wasn't any building yet. It gave me access to play a new extraction, kind of like shooter, shrinking world, that was popular on PC, but like not super popular on consoles or anywhere else. So it was the first big cross-platform title. And then they shifted to mobile so quickly. It kind of gave me the vision of, like, over time, more games being free to play and more games being experienced on mobile as they were experienced on PC and console, which was just a really novel concept at the time. And it got me even more interested in the gaming industry. So that was definitely a huge shift.
I would also just point out with this generation, you know, Microsoft had Sony on the ropes in Gen 7, especially if you go ex Japan, they outsold them by a decent margin, right? And I think that's an important benchmark for Microsoft, because I don't think they're ever going to compete in Japan unless they really aggressively start acquiring JRPG studios, which they really haven't. And I think there's cultural reasons that they probably shouldn't. But, you know, when you think about just where they've competed historically, they were beating them in Europe and in North America, which is huge for Xbox at that point. And then for Sony to just come out and just, you know, say, we're the 8,000 pound gorilla in the room. You guys can go back in your place. Here's all our content. You know, they just dropped it on the table. Like 51 million units for Microsoft isn't like, that's not mice nuts. Like that's a decent showing, but being outsold by 2.5 times plus or minus by Sony in the generation, especially when some of the biggest games of that generation were third party, whether it's the Call of Duties, whether it's GTA, whether it's Fortnite. You know, the fact that you're being outsold by that much because you weren't prepared on the content front, that was interesting. That was just a really great strategic play by Sony. And we've seen Microsoft trying to close that gap. You know, once they realized they lost the eighth generation, they bought ZeniMax. They've made a few other acquisitions for studios. They've just been trying to beef up Activision potentially if that goes through. But, you know, even so, some of the early content from ZeniMax has not been great. Redfall is, I think it's the worst rated ZeniMax game of all time on Metacritic, which Metacritic is always, you know, iffy, but like that says something, right? Like it's clear that they have issues internally in how they do this and what they're trying to do. And you can't just, you know, maybe with all their generative AI, with OpenAI, they can fix that down the road. I don't know. It's stupid, but you know, I think it really does show the deficiencies in the content generation they had relative to Sony at this stage.
All right. So all the way to the present, we'll talk about the ninth generation last, and then we'll go into a little more of a discussion phase. So this is deemed as like 2021 to present day, but there's a big caveat in there because Nintendo kind of went mid-cycle on everybody and took over the world. So PS5 launched in November 2020. 34.4 million units roughly to date. Xbox X or SSX, November 2020 as well. So lockstep again. And sell through there has been about 21.7. So there's some issues here that we can talk about in a little more detail about the pandemic thing that happened and everything else that caused some share shifts and things like that. And also the availability of consoles actually being able to be sold during the holiday season and things like that, whenever things are usually very robust. For PS5, you know, the story is still being written. Oftentimes it takes a little while for the software to catch up with the hardware, but they've already got some great titles out there like Last of Us and Horizon Forbidden West, God of War, Demon's Souls, another Ratchet and Clank, and Returnal. They have an SSD inside, 4K and HDR support, dual entitlement and cross-platform progression. Xbox, we'll just skip to that real quick. Again, Halo Infinite, which was reasonably well received. Not to Matt though, Forza and Fable. And then their innovations here was Game Pass, which we'll probably dive into a little bit further in the discussion, and cloud gaming, which again is kind of becoming or was becoming ubiquitous, but it's still kind of touch and go. But let's talk about the Switch because that launched in March 2017. They've done 125.1 million units to date, roughly, and just went all in on content. I mean, Mario Kart, Animal Crossing, SSB, Legend of Zelda, The New Link, Pokemon Sword and Shield, Scarlet, Violet, like you name it, that Mario Odyssey, all of these games were just fantastic and outstripping their own internal expectations. And, you know, it was just it's been a very good cycle for them. And again, this is like they were not just like first to market, but first to market in a material way. Launched with an amazing marketing campaign. Every time I hear someone snap their fingers, I instantly think of Switch. Killer content again, novel Joy-Con controllers, local multiplayer, seamless TV integration, and then the best indie and third-party support they've ever had. And, you know, portable. So over the years, Nintendo's had these ecosystems that kind of coexisted. They would play around in console a little bit. They'd have like a banger year or a banger cycle with the handheld. But like they brought it together in just a really cohesive, beautiful package. So I'll just leave it there and see what you guys were doing in 2021, which was not too long ago.
Yeah, I think for me, of the consoles of this generation, I mean, I think you have to have a Switch, definitely. but, you know, a lot of the games that you mentioned, I've played at least a fair amount. And I think that my kids play that. And especially if you're a parent with kids, you have to have a Switch. I think you have to have a PS5 because of the promise of content and existing content there. I just don't see a reason why you would need to get an Xbox today. I mean, just the content lineup there for me isn't very compelling. So I don't know. For me, I'm a little bit concerned about Microsoft and Xbox being a viable platform in the mid to longer term future.
I have all three, so you know I spoiled myself. But and where was I? I was in Hong Kong when these came out too, so I had, you know, I was in lockdown in Hong Kong. I had nothing better to do but play games. I think this generation is the most interesting for me because this is where we really, and we'll dive into the strategy more so, but this is where really Nintendo, Sony, and Microsoft really started to diverge, right? Sony is doing what they did best. Here's all of this amazing content, buy our box to play it. And maybe at some point in the future, we'll put some of it on PC now, but that's like a year or two after it comes out, right? Microsoft is, all right, here's a box. It's really powerful, but you can also get Game Pass on PC. And just sub to Game Pass. I don't care where you do it, use that. If it's going to be cloud streamed, if it's going to be on PC or console, I mean, I don't have any intimate knowledge of negotiations, but I can almost 100% guarantee that if Sony would agree to it, Game Pass would be on PS5 also. Like, I think that's something that Microsoft would do in a heartbeat if Sony would allow, right? They want, and they've said this, Satya has said this, they want consumer subscriptions to match their enterprise office subscriptions. And gaming is the forefront of that. And they want to grow Game Pass to be that. So Sony's focused on buy our box to play our games. Microsoft is focused on subscribe to our thing. It's a great value. And then you have Nintendo doing their own thing. And what I think they did really successfully in this generation, exactly to Brian's point, is they said, here's a device that's purpose-built for our amazing IP, and here's all of our IP in succession. I also think they were aided by the pandemic, and you cannot rule out the boost because sales were coming. Switch sales were already kind of peaking right before COVID hit. And when COVID hit, it was just like, nope, here is the next, you know, giant wave of Switch sales and content, right? So it's hard to kind of, you know, A-B test that because you can't, but I don't think they would have sold 125 million units of the Switch without COVID. Like, I just don't think that would have happened. But things like Ring Fit even selling tens of, you know, over 10 million units, right? You know, lots of the, you know, if you look at the list of 10 million unit sellers in this generation, it's so huge. And it just speaks to what they did really well. They found a middle ground to be the secondary console to Microsoft and Sony rather than competing with them, and led with content. And that was just huge for them.
Yeah, I think maybe one other thing I could jump in here with is I think there's, in this generation, I think there is a little bit of a different environment in the sense that I think that it's no longer PlayStation versus Switch versus Xbox. I think it's PlayStation versus Switch versus PC, right? Because if you think about historically, PlayStation was always the best platform to play RPG games and narrative-based, you know, action adventure types of games, right? Switch with Nintendo platforms, you always want, you know, that's the place you go to for Pokemon and you know, those kind of IP titles. And for an FPS, it used to be Halo and Xbox, but now, like, you know, my kids, instead of, for us, we didn't get the latest Xbox. Instead, they both got PCs and they're playing Valorant all day long. So I do think we are probably at an inflection point for when players think about FPS, they're not going to be thinking Xbox. They're going to be thinking PC. And I think increasingly more people are going to just get a PC instead of getting an Xbox.
I got a few outliers here as well, but the other thing worth pointing out is that this is also the era of mass consolidation in video games. And let's just set aside mobile for now, because that was where a lot of it happened. Microsoft, at one of the E3s, I don't remember exactly which year it was, but they bought 5 studios and just announced it. And Phil was like, look at what I did. I just brought in 5 new studios. This is going to proliferate. We're going to have a bunch of new first-party content. And then Sony responded by buying Bungie, which of course was the studio that essentially made Xbox by producing Halo. And I think that sets up an interesting juxtaposition too, because for all the lip service that Microsoft gives about open platforms and things like that, their Bethesda acquisition, which was a $10 billion deal, and subsequent acquisitions, like, they are not open platforms. Even Redfall, for instance, that, you know, I'm not sure why Sony players would play that, but they don't have the opportunity to for a while. Starfield is coming out later this year, which is a very it's a very exciting game for gamers because it's been teased forever, and Bethesda is an amazing studio, but that also won't be available on Sony. But if you think about Sony and the Bungie acquisition, Marathon, which is another game that people have been in a fury about, will be available cross-platform. And if I had my druthers on that one, I do believe that's contractual. Bungie was a very attractive asset, and for sure they wouldn't sell to someone that would make their game unavailable to the masses. But it's an interesting juxtaposition to see, like, that play out, because Sony has never wanted their greatest hits on Microsoft consoles. So that's an important one to look out for. There's some other things, like other entrants, that I kind of want to get your guys' view on too. So we have Valve and the Steam Deck. That's done about 3 million units, maybe a little bit more than that in 2023. Do we think that is a viable candidate? And let's also juxtapose that against the new Sony handheld, which was introduced in May, Project Q, which is coming out in November. So how do you think those fare together? Very similar offerings, right? But what's up?
I think if we were to think about competitive alternatives, you're always with a handheld device, you're always going to be comparing against phone, right? And I just don't know what, you know, I mean, well, so exclusive content could be one thing, but then is it dramatically better? And look, I'm a guy who has owned, you know, almost every DS. I own a PSP and, it's just with the phone, I just think it's a very difficult challenge to build and communicate a value proposition when everyone's got a phone. So I don't know. I'm a little bit negative in terms of some of these handheld offerings coming up, but you know, I hope I'm wrong, but I'm skeptical.
These feel like very 2021-y things where there was lots of free capital and people were just throwing stuff at R&D to see what sticks because they're all coming out now. I think to JK's point, like with the Xbox today, like they don't need a handheld because you can just cloud stream to your phone. Like I can go sit outside in my backyard and play MLB The Show or whatever game I want to play stream from my Xbox on my Wi-Fi network. It's not going to be the, you know, I wouldn't play Call of Duty doing that because I'm going to have lag doing it. But like to play something that's offline where it's just me, like that's a great, you know, and whether it's my phone, a tablet, whatever device I already have, like I don't need another thing to go with that to do that. And so I just think it's a product that was designed with this work from home, we're all going to be home forever mentality. And it doesn't really fit the modern world that we're in where, you know, everything changed very quickly after changing very quickly and how we live, work and play and everything. And, you know, I think over time, if cloud really becomes competitive on a latency basis, like then these things could potentially become valuable. But again, your phone does it too. So why would you spend $300-$400 on something that your phone can do? It's the same argument for like VR. There's not great or differentiated content yet. You've already got to own a $500 PS5 and then you got to spend $500 on a headset. It's like, so it's $1,000 gating for content that isn't great. It's the same content. It's just an extra couple hundred bucks to play it on a small screen where I need to wear glasses anyways. Like it's not an optimal experience. And I think it just misses the boat.
Yeah. It's like when the iPhone came out, everyone stopped buying iPods. Right. And now this strategy is like, okay, well, we're going to try to disrupt the iPhone with a single purpose gaming device. I don't know. I just think it's going to be very challenging.
Yeah, I would say like a lot of this was emulating the success of the Switch, which again kind of beat them to market in this arena. I would say Sony's got a way better chance of making a dent in this market than Valve. But I would also say like Microsoft has said they're not interested, and I continue to believe that that's true. And there's companies like Logitech and others filling the gap. I think that is a huge losing proposition because if you don't own the distribution, there's no reason to be in the gaming hardware business. So that would be a big loser, in my opinion. I guess
I think the Sony Project Q would be more successful if it wasn't tied to the PS5, right? If this was a standalone device where you could buy games and play them directly on it rather than remote play from your PS5, then you're competing with the Nintendo DS and all of the Game Boy, you know, spawns all the next generation there, right? That's a different market opportunity you're going after. Now you're saying I can have PlayStation IP wherever I want it. That's a cool concept. To tie it to the hardware, to PS5, I just think that opportunity basically is gone.
Yeah, say we got a really good look at Nintendo financials. I think like in May, they dropped something recent as of end of March or something like that. So we have a good backward-looking view and guidance for the full year. There was nothing in there about a new hardware cycle. And again, this is 2017 we're talking about. It's been, if I'm doing my math right, 6 years since the last one. And Matt, I know you spend a lot of time on the semi supply chain and specifically in Asia. So I think you mentioned you may have heard something, but what are your indications there?
So Sharp supplies the displays for the Switch, and they said that they had secured a contract design for the next generation console business for one of their customers. We can do math, right? So whether that's this year or next year, there's clearly some sort of reference design being set upon where Sharp now has the contract to build whatever the next generation product or the display for the next generation Nintendo product. I think that's what that's telling us is, number one, it's going to be some sort of a handheld or hybrid again, because they're going to have a display built into it, right? So that's kind of already interesting. Whether it's just a Switch Pro and it's backwards compatible or it's a brand new thing, I think we'll find out over time, particularly with, you know, from AMD. We'll see what they start saying about their semi-custom business, because that's where they make the chips for Sony and Microsoft. They didn't make the chips for the Switch. That's NVIDIA, but, you know, Nintendo has gone back and forth over time. So we'll listen to see what's going on in those businesses. But, you know, just it seems like, even though Nintendo is being quiet on the next generation, the supply chain is starting to get ready for it. And I think that's what tells you that it's probably 12 to 18 months away. Is it this holiday season? I think that's a little tight, because they probably would have had to tell the market that it's coming, and it would have had to be in the guidance if it was this holiday, because they'd basically be announcing it now, because this is, you know, E3 is dead, but this would have been the E3 time. This would have been the time for them to do a direct and announce it. So I think we're probably looking more at sometime in calendar 24, probably the holidays. But the Switch was also randomly a March release. I mean, I think that had to do more with the Wii U just being a flop than anything, and they just wanted to get it out. But I think, the supply chain is telling us they're starting to get ready, and that's the indicator that something is close.
Hey folks, our discussion today on Console Wars has run a bit long, and the second part of our discussion is fairly different from the first half, so we split it up. Make sure to like and follow if you want to see more of this content, and stay tuned until next week when we discuss a lot of the strategic and the pixel side of the conversation on the Console Wars. Catch you all next time.